It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, is Wisconsin moving to the right politically? We'll get a conservative perspective and ask for your thoughts as well.
First, a school accountability bill drafted by Republicans in the state assembly was introduced yesterday, and it could have serious implications for failing public schools in Wisconsin.
Under the bill, failing schools would be converted to public schools, I should say, would be converted to independent charter schools. For private schools, all state payments would be cut off if they're failing for at least 4 years.
Here with us now to talk about the bill is Aaron Richards, education reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Aaron, welcome back.
Hello.
So the big headline here seems to be the turning failing public schools into charter schools part of this. So let's dig into that. What exactly is the plan here?
The plan, as it's outlined right now in the bill that's been put forward by the Assembly Republicans, is to put forward a bill that would actually have some sanctions when it comes to schools that persistently underperform for a number of years. If you're a public school, the idea would be that you underperform for a certain number of years, and then at that point, this new academic review board, that would be a new board set up, would say, okay, if you don't have the capacity to improve, we will convert you to a charter school. So the idea would be that this new board would evaluate proposals from charter school operators that could potentially take over that school. If there are no charter providers that want to take over that school, then the school board would be forced to turn their own school into a charter school.
And that's the plan for public schools that are deemed to be failing in Wisconsin. What about private schools?
Sure. So, again, this accountability bill is aimed at trying to bring all the publicly funded schools in Wisconsin into one single system where we would have some idea of how these schools are doing, and if the reviews show they're not doing well, that there's something that has to kick in to change them. For the private schools, which aren't part of any accountability system right now, the state could cut off payment to them if they underperformed for 3 consecutive years. They could cut off payments. They could say that the school couldn't accept new students, and that would have to happen for at least, I think, 4 years, 2 or 4 years. There's some technical language in there about which one they'd have to choose, and then they could reapply to have students come. But for practical effect, the idea would be to cut off their payment, which we often know results in the schools not being able to continue very successfully, if not shut down altogether.
And at the crux of all of this, the bill would also create an academic review board, a new entity that would develop a new system for evaluating schools. What do we know about what that board would be, what it would look like?
Well, this is really probably one of the most controversial parts of the bill. The new board would be made up of 12 members plus the superintendent of the state school systems. The devil's in the details. The bill is very explicit that, it says what job titles people have to have and that, you know, the governor would have one individual that he or she could appoint to the board, but then the other person would have to come from, a charter school or a private school. Certain lawmakers have a person that they can appoint, but they have to come from a specific sector, such as the type of school or a higher education institution. And this is where there's been a lot of controversy, even from the Republicans, who are largely in favor of some kind of accountability system, but think that this is far too specific and may not even stand up to a legal challenge, because in some ways it could usurp the authority of the state superintendent altogether. While the state superintendent does have nominees on this board, the way it's set up, it may not be able to withstand a legal challenge, or at least that's what some people are saying behind the scenes.
Right. Democrat Sandy Pope from the Assembly has said that she thinks a lawsuit is a possibility. She sees this as an overreach into DPI territory. Do you see that as something that would unfold if this went forward, or something that the Assembly is looking at?
I think that it would certainly be within the realm of likelihood if this goes forward. I think what we have to remember here, though, is, this has been put forth by the Assembly Republicans, who have been much more aggressive on the school accountability front. there are several key Republicans in the Senate who are not on board with this bill as it's been proposed. Senate Republicans are coming up with their own school accountability that I imagine will look different than this. So the fact that this is out there, you know, the only way a lawsuit would kick in, I would suspect, is if this actually passed as it is written. But certainly there are concerns from Democrats that the board would be an overreach. There are concerns, frankly, from the conservatives in many sectors have stood up today and said they actually think that the board emboldens the DPI's potential control or authority over the private voucher schools, and they don't like it for that reason. You also have some more Tea Party-aligned individuals who have looked at this bill and said, we don't want an accountability bill at all. All of the ideas and, you know, control over schools should all be local. There should be no state system that holds schools accountable. So you're really hearing from a lot of different people about this bill.
Now, one aspect of it that we haven't touched on yet is the testing involved. One of the tools that would assess whether the school was passing or failing. What do we know about how testing might work under this bill?
This is a very important piece. At the moment, all the publicly funded schools in Wisconsin take the same state achievement test. That's a relatively new change for private voucher schools, but traditional public schools and charter schools have taken that test for a long time. That test is changing this year to a different type of test, but the idea is everybody takes the same test. Even if they don't like the test, it's the same test given to the same kids at the same grades under the same types of conditions. When those results come out, even if we don't particularly like the test, we at least have some idea how everybody did on it. What the Republicans are proposing is to say this academic review board could approve multiple kinds of tests and that schools could be able to pick the test that they would like to use. For practical purposes, though, the public schools are beholden by a federal law that says they must administer the same test. So even though the bill would give flexibility, the only schools that would be able to use that flexibility would be the private voucher schools. On the other hand, there's a state agency at the University of Wisconsin-Madison that does a lot of overview comparison of test scores and testing purposes, and they have said it is technically possible to use different tests and to look at the results of those tests. But the more and different types of tests you use, the more unlikely it is you'll have a reliable, you know, the most reliable way to look at school and student performance is for everybody to take the same test. And that's what the this institution at UW-Madison has said. Even though it's technically possible, it's probably not the best way to look at school performance.
So this is just a proposed bill in the Assembly at this point, but there's already a lot of disagreement among Republicans who proposed it. What do you expect to happen next? What's the next movement?
The Assembly Education Committee is scheduled to have a hearing on this bill next week. That would be January 14th, Wednesday morning. The Senate Republicans are meeting, have met, were supposed to meet today about their version of the bill. It's unclear when that version, the Senate version, will come out, but I suspect that all of this activity has probably resulted in a relatively speedy timeline to get that out into the mix as well. I've heard that there is appetite among the Assembly Republicans to have something approved as early as the end of this month, but given the amount of concern, opposition, people talking about this thing, I'm not entirely convinced that will happen. It may take longer to get to something that would be agreeable or at least have enough votes to pass both houses.
Aaron, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Aaron Richards, education reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel.
Yesterday, we checked in on homeless people and how they deal with bitter cold. We heard from a Madison-based service provider. Today, we head west. If someone finds themselves without a home in La Crosse, there are a few places they can turn to if they need shelter. There's the Salvation Army, the warming center run by the La Crosse Catholic Diocese. But a coalition wants to provide even more spaces for people to go where they can also receive counseling and job assistance. Maureen McCollum has more.
John Page spends his days searching for computer drafting jobs at the library. His evenings are spent at the Warming Center in downtown La Crosse. Paige sleeps in one of the facility's recliners during the cold winter months. He likes to pick a plush turquoise one in the corner near the TV.
But I don't watch that much TV. I'm too busy trying to figure out what I'm going to do the next day.
Paige says there are so many reasons people come to stay at the warming center. Some have lost their jobs, and other people have lost their homes.
Some come in from divorce, some from their attempts to stop from drinking. And then we have those that come from jail, and they need a place to stay. So this is actually a very good place for people to start their life again.
Paige is one of at least 35 people who sleep at the warming center on any given night. It moved from a new location in November, more than doubling in size. It now provides showers, laundry, and a kitchen for the guests, services the former, more cramped location could not provide. The expansion is just one of three phases a coalition is working on to provide more services to homeless people in the area. The second piece involves opening a daytime drop-in center, which organizers hope to have open within the next few weeks in downtown La Crosse. People will be able to stop in for a cup of coffee or a sandwich. They'll also be able to meet with staff from area nonprofits that work on healthcare, jobs, and housing. Mary Fitzpatrick is the coordinator of the Warming Center, run by Catholic Charities of the Diocese of La Crosse.
Whether they're a vet, you know, and connecting them with the VA that has wonderful programs for the homeless, or Cooley Cap, you know, who has transitional housing programs for the homeless mentally ill, you know, it'll be a real collaborative effort that's expanded even more.
The drop-in center will be run by the Franciscan Sisters of Perpetual Adoration. Sister Karen Neuser is helping coordinate the effort. She says creating a daytime space shows people who are homeless that many in the community truly care about them.
And if people care, you can actually face life and go on. Without having somebody really care, you lose hope. You lose any impetus to go further.
The third phase of the initiative is building transitional housing and a job training center downtown within a year. Rick Staff is president of Gerard Heschler Realtors, which has been instrumental in purchasing and finding properties for the project.
There's a garage there now, and so we could start with the construction skills training program immediately because there's a vacant lot, so room to learn how to put together walls and those things. But eventually we hope to have food service skills and other related type of skills that people can take into the wide community and find a job. And eventually we'll need a facility. And when we build that, we hope to have some housing built there as well to serve the same groups.
Back at the Warming Center, John Page says all the coordinated efforts should help people in his situation, jobless and homeless, find a new beginning.
It's a coming together of the community with resources and people to try and put their lives together again. There's a family quality about this.
A positive quality, Page says, that can make the La Crosse community stronger in the long run. Maureen McCollum, Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse.
Governor Walker was sworn in for term two earlier this week, and as the legislature gets into action, there's a bigger Republican majority than in the previous session.
That's led some observers from the left and the right to wonder, is Wisconsin making an overall shift to the conservative side? And if so, what does that mean for the state?
We heard from Paul Fanlon of the Capital Times on this issue last Friday. Now for a different perspective, Brett Healy joins us. He's president of the John K. McIver Institute here in Wisconsin. Brett, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on, Rob.
Well, let's start with that basic question. Is Wisconsin making a fundamental shift to the right politically?
Well, I think if you're a Republican politician or work for the Republican Party, you certainly would want to assert that somehow there's a shift, a cultural shift ongoing in this state. But I think if you take a step back, I think it's really hard to make that case. And if you're being intellectually honest about the question, I think you have to come to the determination that Wisconsin is truly a purple state. We have all sorts of examples up and down the line, both on Republican and Democrat side, that show the Wisconsin voter has an independent streak, really not seen in very many other states in the country. It wasn't that long ago when President Obama did really well in his first run here in Wisconsin, 56%. And there was a talk. There was talk back then that somehow there was a cultural shift going on, and that perhaps we were entering into a golden age for the Democrats. So I think you have to caution the politicians and the partisans when they start to talk about this sort of thing. I think in reality, you can't ignore the gains that the Republican Party made in the last election. It's impressive that they have 63 seats in the Assembly, and when a special election is done, they'll have 19 in the Senate. You know, I can't remember a time when the Republicans had that many members in the state legislature, but I really don't think we'll know if there's something bigger, broader going on until that, until the next presidential election. As I said before, the President Obama's done obviously very well in this state, and I think when it becomes an open seat again and you have a contested race with no incumbent, I think we'll have a better idea if the gains, the recent gains, were temporary, or if it is, in fact, something more fundamental that is going on here in Wisconsin.
Well, the examples of Democratic success have been the last couple of presidential elections, Tammy Baldwin, of course, winning a Senate seat. But when it comes to state government itself, at least, you know, 2010, recall elections in 2012, even though President Obama won, Republicans held on to the legislature. Big success this last time around. Why do you think the state GOP has been so successful in elections for governor and for the state legislature?
Well, I think when you talk about state legislative races, having worked in the Capitol and spent some time in this area, I think anyone who has had some success will tell you that a key in this area is candidate recruitment. And you need to find the right person in each of these districts, someone who's going to speak to their neighbors, their communities, and carry their message to be successful. So I think people outside the Capitol don't pay enough attention to candidate recruitment. But I also think, too, that we've seen recently here at the local level focus on fiscal issues. Obviously, Republicans consider themselves to be, in general, fiscal conservatives, and they've been having some luck talking about, some good fortune talking about continued tax relief. Wisconsin is well known across the country for its relatively high tax climate, and so Republicans have done a good job in the last two, three election cycles beating that drum that taxpayers deserve more and more tax relief. And then in terms of the recalls, you know, I think we can all agree that that was a historic and a special time here in Wisconsin. And I'm not sure you can really chalk up what happened there to any specific policy issue. I think there were all sorts of underlying and swirling tensions and emotions going on there. And the Republicans obviously negotiated themselves out of what has historically been a difficult spot, and they should be congratulated for that. But I'm not sure you can pin it on a specific issue or a general shift in the population.
Do you think policies like tax cuts are inherently more popular for voters, like fiscal conservatism, or have the Republicans done a better job of selling that message than Democrats have done of selling their own message?
Well, I think anything in politics, doesn't matter what the issue is, doesn't matter what your party is, it comes down to messaging. And clearly, given the direction that we've been heading in this state, both from an electoral standpoint, but also, as you said, from a policy standpoint, continued tax relief for the last 3-4 years here suggests that the Republicans have done a much better job marketing and messaging to taxpayers that they deserve more and more tax relief. Democrats who disagree with that haven't done as good a job making their case that, in fact, state governments, local governments need revenue and we can't afford tax cuts. But that's the great thing about our democratic system in this country. All the debate goes on. Everyone gets to have their say, and then the winner comes out with from the election results. So Republicans, given their historic numbers in the Assembly and the Senate, they've been doing a better job articulating a message that resonates with Wisconsinites all across the state.
We're talking to Brett Healy with the McIver Institute about whether Wisconsin politics are in the midst of a fundamental shift toward the right. He says despite some successes for Republicans, that pendulum might still be swinging.
And you can join our conversation at 800-642-1234. Is Wisconsin, do you think, becoming a more conservative state? Why have Republicans seen such big successes in state elections? And what would the impact be if the state is, in fact, moving to the right? Call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email talk@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation after the news. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're continuing our conversation with Brett Healy from the McIver Institute, looking at Republican dominance in Wisconsin politics as a new session kicks off. And we're asking the question, is Wisconsin moving to the right, maybe for good?
You can give your answer to that question now at 800-642-1234. Are we in the midst of a shift to a more conservative Wisconsin, or will things keep going back and forth? Why do you think Republicans have dominated elections for the legislature and governor the last 4 years or so? What do Republicans need to do to stay on top? What would Democrats need to do to get back in the game? And what policies are you hoping to see from a Republican-led state right now? Or what policies are you fearing you might see? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email talk@wpr.org. Brett, let's get to that question I just asked listeners, whether they're there to stay or not. Republicans are in charge now. What are you hoping comes out of this Republican legislature gets signed by the governor this session?
Well, I think it's interesting to note that you have right now three different top priorities, one from each of the players involved here, the governor, the assembly, and the Senate. If you go back to the gubernatorial race, the governor ran largely on his past accomplishments and didn't talk too much about his agenda for the next term. But the one item he did talk about and talked about specifically was continued tax relief, property tax relief, in this next term. And so the governor, as we speak, is putting together his 2015-2017 budget. And the one item I think we can all be assured that will be in there is a proposal, as you mentioned, on the campaign trail that he hopes to hold property taxes down to a level that's lower in 2018 than it is today. So if that's the case, if he follows through on that, that's going to require some significant resources on his behalf to make that come true. And then in terms of the two houses in the assembly, they apparently their top priority is the school accountability bill, which was unveiled earlier today. Speaker Voss last session expressed disappointment that the two houses couldn't come to an agreement on this issue. And so for a while now, he and the other members of his caucus have talked about making this bill Assembly Bill number one in this new session. And so they just introduced a bill today that would attempt to take schools in the state that are struggling and force them to come up with plans to improve.
and then they go along in this bill to impose sanctions on those schools that do not improve or that are failing for too long. I think based on what we saw last session, this is going to be a controversial subject. It's obviously one that's important to Wisconsin and our children and their education, but there's just no way of knowing if they're going to be able to come to some sort of agreement and get something passed. And then last, the elephant in the room, so to speak, after the election, Senator Fitzgerald, leader of the Republicans in the state Senate, he mentioned how he talked about the need for the Wisconsin legislature and the governor to pass a right-to-work bill. Wisconsin, there are 24 other states right now that have right-to-work states. And from Senator Fitzgerald's perspective, he believes that if we want to move the state forward economically, catch up with our peers in the Midwest, Michigan, Indiana recently became right-to-work states, he believes the time is now for Republicans to pass that and early on in the session. So it's interesting that we have three very different top priorities from the three players involved. I do think that suggests that there's going to be some acrimony. There's going to be some debate back and forth. And if they don't seem to be singing from the same hymnal here at the start of the session, it's tough to see how they pass some of these things quickly, like some are expressing they want to. So,
let's get to our callers now. We've got Jeff on the line in Oshkosh. Jeff, hi.
Hello, Rob. Thank you for taking my call. So the Republicans seem to be more effective at party discipline, and any internal disagreements seem to get settled in private so that publicly they can provide a unified front and actually get their platform and their agenda accomplished. The Democrats, by contrast, seem to have no problem with open disagreements. I remember back to 2008 to 2010, and I've lived in Wisconsin my whole life, and been paying careful attention to politics from an early age. And the Democrats had the governor's house, they had the state Senate, the Assembly, they had President Obama, and both houses of Congress from 2008 to 2010. And as far as their workers' rights, you know, limit corporate tax breaks, whatever environmental platform the Democrats may agree on, they certainly didn't get a lot done, and you never see the kind of squabbling that Senate Majority Leader Decker insisted on having with Governor Doyle, that whatever that led to is just really a surprise for everyone.
Jeff, thanks a lot. Interesting point. Brett, do you buy that? Republicans, when they're in charge, are more effective at overcoming or even concealing conflict and just getting stuff done than Democrats when they're in charge?
They would certainly like to think so. I would say, however, that I think, again, the turmoil around Act 10 and collective bargaining reform, that was such a different time in our state's history, in our politics, that I think that it's not surprising that we saw Republicans sticking together as a team, given what they were facing politically from their opponents, you know, the chaos on Capitol grounds, the mass protests, the citizen demonstrations. So I don't think it's surprising that they were able to exercise discipline within their ranks during that time. I do think this budget is different, the one we're about to get the debate going on, the 2015-2017 budget. It's much more normal, quote-unquote normal budget. And so I do think you're going to see some inner party squabbles break out. We're seeing one of those play out in front of us right now when it comes to right to work. Governor Walker's made it clear for probably 6 to 9 months that he does not think right to work is needed. He's called it a distraction. And yet you had the top Senate Republican, Senator Fitzgerald, even after the governor made his feelings known, you had Senator Fitzgerald come up in a very public way, in a very direct way, and disagree with the governor and say, actually, I think this is needed for the state. This will help us in the future, and we need to do this now. So, both parties like to think that they're good at party discipline. But again, it comes back down to every time the issue, the particular issue you're talking about, and whether or not your party position, you can sell that to your constituents back home. And it just, it depends on the issue itself.
Jeff, thanks for the call. We'll go to Mark in Two Rivers. Mark, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you think?
The reason I was calling is I've had this conversation with my son several times. He likes to talk politics. He's 25 years old and a college graduate. And it's his opinion that a lot of what's going on in the Republican Party is actually a shift in the belief of the party that's coming as a result of the change in the demographics as people in the 18 to about 30 years old who are fiscally conservative, defense conservative, constitutionally conservative, but yet are starting to lean a little bit more to the left on their social policies. And I think maybe perhaps that might be something that you're seeing is a shift in the belief of the party.
Interesting. Mark, thanks a lot for the call. I want to get Brett Healy in on this. So millennial generation starting to emerge into politics now. He says fiscally conservative and conservative in other ways, socially liberal, and the Republican Party should or needs to change to account for that.
Yeah, I agree personally with Mark. The young people that I know that I interact with, they're clearly they have a much more libertarian streak to them than I recall ever seeing in the past. It's tough to put a finite number on that and whether or not that's part of the reason why Republicans in Wisconsin have had some success electorally. It's tough to put your finger on anything specific there. But it is an opportunity, clearly an opportunity for the Republican Party. If more and more young people have a fiscal conservative but socially moderate or liberal streak, they're going to need to adapt to try and gain a foothold with young people, especially as they become of age to vote and move through the workforce. It's going to be critical for either party to try and figure out how to reach those young voters and speak to the issues that they want solved, that they want solutions for.
Brett, we'll leave it there for now. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob.
That's Brett Healy, president of the John K. McIver Institute for Public Policy.
Well, today would have been Elvis Presley's 80th birthday. But before he was a rock and roll icon that we celebrate today, Elvis started out covering other musicians' tunes.
We're joined now by music buff and radio host Rockin' John McDonald from WRT in Madison to talk about Elvis's earlier musical output. John, thanks a lot for joining us here in the studio.
Nice being here.
Well, now we're looking back on Elvis, and we know the whole Elvis thing. But can you try to paint us a picture of what it was like when is this new kid, you know, on the TV, on the radio? What was it like for Americans to see him for the first few times?
It was like a cyclone. That's the only way to describe it. There wasn't really anybody like that before he came along. And it just, he affected a whole bunch of musicians who people tend to forget that. A lot of country singers switched to rock and roll after Elvis hit. They said, he said, Elvis changed everything. That's the expression I heard you hear the most when you talk to musicians in the 50s.
Did people know right away that he was doing something new, something nobody had done before, or did he just have a lot of charisma?
Well, it was a charisma, and all that wiggling and shaking he was doing, too. That kind of helped a lot, but he did he would cover these country songs and all these rhythm and blues songs. He was kind of reworked them. That's what I heard Heartbreak Hotel on the radio when I was a kid, and I heard his name, and I heard this song, and I said, that's a rhythm and blues singer. I was shocked when I found out what he looked like. But I think he was just, you know, he's kind of in the right place. He's right in the middle of the rock and roll scene was just really getting rolling, and he was, I guess, there at the right time.
Let's talk more about that look and what you thought about it. You were shocked. You said a good way or a bad way? Like, what the heck is that? Or did you want to, you know, get a little Elvis into your wardrobe?
Oh, I thought it was cool.
Now, you mentioned he sounded like a rhythm and blues guy. He has a country background. How did those diverse influences shape his music, gospel too, I guess? How did all that meld into what we know as Elvis now?
Yeah, that's a good question, because he kind of did, you know, meld into everything. He could sing everything. He could ballads and, but they were looking for a new sound at Sun Records, and him, Scotty, and Bill, Scotty Moore and Bill Black, they were just messing around in the studio, and Sam Phillips came busting in. He said, "What were you guys just doing?" He said, "Keep doing that." And he ran the tape recorders, and, but, you know, it was a combination. He could sing everything, like I said, and the rhythm and blues stuff, I love his R&B stuff, and he knew R&B. You could just tell by what he recorded.
The gospel part really interests me. I don't think of Elvis as a church boy, not with, you know, his moves on stage, but he got to start singing in church, a Pentecostal church, and it sounds like you can kind of hear that gospel strand all the way to the end of his career.
Yeah, he's, well, that's what he used to do to relax when he was out on the road, out on these long tours. If he was staying in a hotel, he'd make sure there was a piano around, and he would sit around, and all the musicians, they'd all sit around and sing gospel music. He loved gospel music right till the end.
Well, let's give a listen to a little Elvis. One of his earlier hits was his version of the classic Bill Monroe bluegrass song, Blue Moon of Kentucky. He recorded for Sun, I guess, in July of 1954. Here's a taste.
I say blue moon of Kentucky, they keep on shining. Shine on the moon that's gone and left me blue. I say blue moon of Kentucky, they keep on shining. Shine on the moon that's gone and left me blue.
So talk us through that track and how it got Elvis'd.
Well, the Bill Monroe version is straight up almost country bluegrass, and it's got a waltz beat. If you hear the original, Elvis totally reworked it. Changed the beat, changed the tempo, changed the feel of the song. And he did that with a lot of songs. And that's probably a classic example of totally reworking a song and turning it into his style.
And early on, it sounds like a lot of country music DJs said Elvis sounded too black for their listeners, and some people accused him of appropriating that music too, and then R&B stations said he sounded too country. So, I don't know, this guy's clearly doing new things. Did those factors, you know, kind of mash up and spawn rockabilly?
Yeah, it's really like Iron Easy ended up getting played on Top 40 radio all over the place back in the 1950s. And, yeah, he was doing rockabilly, I guess, before the term was invented. There was that term came later. When I was growing up, we didn't call it rockabilly music or doo-wop. It was all rock and roll to us. That's what we called it.
You know, it seems like the safe path, if you want to be a musical success, is to go into that established genre, fit into it. I play country, and the country stations play me. Or I play R&B, and the R&B stations play me. Is this a template for creating something new and successful, bursting those boundaries? Did anybody else do it like Elvis did?
Well, he was the first. I think eventually a lot of rock and rollers started getting played on R&B stations. Carl Perkins' Blue Suede Shoes is a huge hit on the country charts and the rhythm and blues charts, but Elvis got there first. He kind of opened the gates for all these other artists to get on the charts. And it was amazing. These records would hit multiple charts. It wasn't just Top 40. A lot of these singles that Elvis did hit everything, R&B, country. And I can still remember hearing Heartbreak Hotel, on the radio. I went, whoa.
What kind of music is that?
Yeah. Yeah.
A lot of people seem to have a favorite Elvis period, the early Elvis. A lot of the country fans like that. The middle Elvis could be the golden. I don't know. There must be somebody who likes the later Elvis as well. I don't know who they are. But do you have a favorite period of Elvis where you think he really was the most Elvis-y Elvis?
It has to be the 1950s. To me, that's when I got hooked on him. Maybe I'm kind of partial. But
what did he sing then?
Oh, he was singing flat-out rock and roll records and ballads, and he had a small band playing with him. And the 60s, he got a little more poppy. Mm-hmm. His music got a little more of the pop sound, and he started doing those movie soundtracks. And in the 70s, it's more glitz and Las Vegas, and he was doing a lot of songs. He liked all the songs he did, or he wouldn't have recorded them or performed them. But to me, it's the 1950s. That's the real Elvis to me.
Well, let's stay in the 50s. We mentioned Elvis making appearances on TV. Here's a clip of his 1956 song, Too Much. This is him on the Ed Sullivan Show in 1957. And our producer told us this is one of your favorites.
Yeah, to me, that's my favorite Elvis song. It's just, it's a rocker. What more can you say? And my dad heard it on the radio when he was driving home from work, and he said, I think I just heard Elvis's new record on the radio. It's called Too Much. I'll give you guys your allowance. You can go buy it in the record store. And I would have been 12 years old, I think. My brother was about 9. So we got hooked early on rock and roll.
Now, at the end of his career, Elvis seemed to go back to those roots. And you know, we talked about gospel. He seemed to fill his live sets with country music and gospel music again. What do you make of that?
Well, he's doing what he wanted. His fans, you know, his gospel albums sold really well. A lot of his fans, you know, bought them. And I think he won Grammys for one or two of them, I think. So, he just was kept going back to, you know, to the gospel stuff because he loves singing it and he just loved performing it. I mean, he's doing How Great Thou Art, you know, as part of his live set in the 70s. And as I said a couple times, he could sing anything. I think that's kind of been overlooked about what a great singer he was.
Now, he appealed to a lot of generations over the years. I got to ask, there's your dad telling you, hey, I heard this Elvis song on the radio. Here's your allowance money. Did he like Elvis, too?
Yeah, my parents were kind of strange in the 1950s. Most parents were trying to keep their kids away from rock and roll. My parents were giving my brother and I an allowance to go out and buy 45s. They like Elvis. They like Buddy Holly. They like Fats Domino. Chuck Berry. So I had, when I moved here in 1957, I had quite a stash of 45s when I got here.
And that stuck. That stash has been growing, hasn't it?
Yeah. Keeps growing. I'm still buying them.
You're talking about his voice as something that people overlook, and I was struck by, especially that first Sun Records tune that we played there, Blue Moon. His voice is amazing. I mean, he can dance, he can do it all, but his voice, what is it about Elvis's voice, do you think, that makes him so special?
Well, it's unique. You know it's Elvis when you hear it. But he had a song called It's Now or Never in the early 60s, and he hits this real high note at the end of it. If you've ever heard the song, you know, give it listen. And he could really sing. And I think people just remember the shaking and the wiggling and the stage shows and
the sequins and all that
the
stuff.
The jumpsuits.
Well, the voice was amazing. John, thank you for coming on and talking Elvis with us today.
Thanks for having me.
We've been speaking with Rockin' John McDonald, the host of the radio show I Like It Like That on Wart in Madison.